This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, January 7th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Two historic stories erupted yesterday in the waning days of the Trump presidency. Early in the morning of January 6th, Reverend Raphael Warnock was declared the winner of his Senate runoff race in Georgia. In the afternoon, John Ossoff was declared the winner of his Senate race in the state. As of January 20th, the Democratic Party will control both houses of Congress as well as the presidency. In Washington, just before the Senate met to take the pro forma electoral vote count affirming Joe Biden as the next president, Trump gave a speech before thousands of supporters, telling them yet again that the election was stolen. He urged them to march on the Capitol. "You will never take back your country with weakness," he said. "You have to show strength and you have to be strong." As commanded, a mob of pro-Trump fanatics marched down the National Mall to the Hill, pushed past security, and broke into the Capitol, scaling walls and breaking windows and doors. For hours, as members of Congress sheltered in secure locations, the rioters roamed through the building, occupying both chambers and vandalizing and ransacking the offices of elected officials. Several hours later, after a curfew was imposed on the city and order was restored to the building, the counting continued. A joint session of Congress was gaveled to a close at 3:44 a.m. on Thursday, and Biden officially became the president-elect. Raphael Warnock delivered a statement shortly after he was declared the winner of his Senate race.
"I remember my dad in this moment. He used to wake me up every morning at dawn. It was morning, but it was still dark. It's dark right now, but morning comes. And scripture tells us that weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes in the morning. Let us rise up, greet the morning, and meet the challenges of this moment. Together we can do the necessary work and win the future for all of our children."
Charles Bethea, a New Yorker staff writer based in Atlanta, joins me to discuss the long, violent history that led to this moment in Georgia and what the Democratic Party's prospects are for the future there and elsewhere in the South. Welcome back, Charles.
Thank you so much.
Especially in an incredibly busy week for you. I really appreciate it. Let's start with Georgia, your home territory. You are a seventh-generation Georgian, I just discovered, and a close watcher of state politics. So I wanted to hear how the election looked from your perspective. Early voting began on December 14th. What do we know about how that went, and what was the state of the race going into Election Day?
Well, the early voting numbers were really, really huge, and they favored Democrats. There was a margin for the Democrats of something like 250,000 to 300,000 votes going into Election Day. That was a huge margin, a huge cushion that they'd created. There had been a real push to get Democrats out early, and knowing that Republicans tend to show up on Election Day, and also knowing that Republicans tend to do better in runoffs in this state than Democrats. I think Republicans had won something like the last 14 out of 15 runoffs in this state. So there was a huge amount of energy and effort put into changing that from happening again.
So Georgia, as we know, has a long, very long history of voter suppression targeting communities of color. But I haven't heard any reports of egregious irregularities at voting sites this time. Are there stories we missed, or did things go pretty smoothly?
Things went very smoothly, as they did in November, despite what, you know, you're hearing from Trump and his acolytes about the election in Georgia. Gabe Sterling and Secretary of State Raffensperger, two Republicans and Trump supporters, have been very effectively debunking a lot of the rumors and claims otherwise since November, and have been doing the same thing since the runoffs as well. One of the most incredible stories coming out of the numbers, which are still emerging from the runoffs, is that it looks like we may have seen that this election had the largest number of African-American voters voting in any election in a single state in history.
Well,
let that sink in for a second.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that.
It may fall just short of that record number, but it could also eclipse it. We won't know for maybe a week or two, but, you know, it's just incredible because this state doesn't have as many Black voters as New York or as California, but they're just incredibly motivated this time.
Yeah, and we also know that a vast majority of Black voters supported the two Democrats and that most white voters went Republican. So that is no surprise. But it does show what you're talking about the power of the Black vote and about Georgia emerging as a purple state. And on the other hand, Trump seems to have sown so much confusion and cynicism that he actually helped Warnock and Ossoff win. So maybe help us understand that a little bit. Is Georgia bluer than we thought, or was the result the outcome of this bizarre moment in American politics?
I think it's worth pushing back a little on the knee-jerk sort of response in some liberal corners that Georgia is now a blue state. Even Nse Ufot, who is the CEO of the New Georgia Project, this voter registration group founded by Stacey Abrams, pushed back on that notion when I presented it to her. It's really too soon to call Georgia anything but a battleground, which is itself new and notable. Going into the runoffs, there really was a 50-50 electorate here, which is why getting out the vote was really the name of the game. In the state, there's this rule of thumb that holds that if Black voters make up more than 30% of the total electorate and they get support from 30% or more of the state's white voters, then Democrats win. And while Democrats didn't get hit that 30% number with Black voters quite in November, which I think partly explains the narrowness of Biden's win, they did exceed 30% in the runoffs, which was critical and which we're seeing in headlines that the Black vote really carried the runoffs for Democrats.
And you also mentioned that a lot of the credit has rightly gone to Stacey Abrams. And also, it's worth mentioning other grassroots organizers, many of them also Black women, who have been building this broad, multi-ethnic Democratic coalition in Georgia. Could you just talk a little bit about what specific efforts those groups have undertaken for these Senate runoffs?
Well, I mean, none of them were reinventing the wheel. They've just done them in great force, you know, knocking on something like 3 million doors in the last month. I mean, that's more doors than were knocked on for the presidential race here. 2 million text messages. There's a Latino group that apparently knocked on the door of every single Latino voter in the state. We do hear rightfully about a lot of the groups that have been targeting Black voters, but Latino voters also were contacted, as were Asian American voters, with figures like Andrew Yang showing up here. I walked around with him one day. I mean, it's just been no corner, I think, has been left unvisited in this state.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The media talked about Warnock and Ossoff as a pair, same with Loeffler and Perdue. That made sense since Democrats, you know, couldn't become the majority party in the Senate without a dual victory. But Warnock's race against Loeffler was decided by a wider margin than Ossoff's against Perdue. What made Warnock, who is a Black preacher, a more attractive candidate than young white Loeffler?
Well, I think it's worth looking at the difference between Perdue and Loeffler. First of all, Ossoff was running against, in Perdue, a much more well-known and well-liked Republican. The Perdue name has clout here in the state, both because he's been a senator for two terms, but also because Sonny Perdue, Trump's Secretary of Agriculture, was governor here not long ago and pretty well-liked. Loeffler, meanwhile, was from the start viewed as something of a latecomer and an opportunist. One Republican described her to me as a political hobbyist. She didn't have the same bona fides here, which is why she tacked so far to the right, I think, with some of her messaging and her ads. She was saying she was more conservative than Attila the Hun. That got a lot of attention, rightfully. So this put, I think, a few moderate Republicans, along with her stock scandal that emerged before Purdue's, that I think it turned off a few moderate Republicans, this sort of extreme right fringe messaging from her. But I think Warnock also, to your question, also had an obvious appeal to a lot of Black Georgians that Biden and Ossoff, frankly, didn't. Not that Biden and Ossoff weren't liked by Black Georgians, but one Black Democrat actually told me that he felt Warnock had gone through a lot of the same things in life that he had. And that perception, I think, is very powerful and helps lead to the huge turnout, Black turnout in these races.
So the Loeffler and Purdue did enthusiastically embrace President Trump. They sort of had no choice.
Gun to the head, yeah.
They took up his claim that the election in Georgia had been stolen from him. And before the events at the Capitol, Loeffler had planned to object to the certification of Georgia's electoral votes. Did that strategy prove to be a benefit or a liability?
I'm not sure I can say with certainty, but what I can say with certainty is that it was a desperate 11th hour move from her. I think realizing that she was behind Warnock, I mean, most polls showed in the last few days before the runoffs that she was behind him by some margin. And she, you know, continuing to make the extreme rightward swerve that she did throughout her campaign, did the most extreme thing she could to try to bring any sort of fence-dwelling Republican to vote for her. So she jumped on board this, you know, undermining democracy move from the dozen or so senators that had planned to object to the certification. I will say I was at a Trump rally in Dalton, Georgia, the night before the election, and it was not a very well attended affair compared to others that I'd been to and seen. He was sort of low energy. It was cold. For these and other reasons, about half the hardcore Trump followers who were there left before he was done and before Loeffler had even spoken. So I'm not sure that, you know, those who were there who were really excited about Trump and maybe still curious to learn more about Loeffler, they weren't even around to hear her final message about objecting to certification. So I'm just not sure that it really got through to that many people, either in person or through other avenues.
Tell us about, you've talked to a lot of Georgia officials. Tell us about Gabriel Sterling, whose title, I believe, is the Voting System Implementation Manager. You know, sounds like a pretty bureaucratic position. But since November, Sterling's received many death threats. I think a website showed a picture of his house with a gun sight over it. The threat of political violence is more potent than ever as in Georgia, and as we saw yesterday in Washington and across the country. What are the forces driving that violence from where you're sitting?
Well, first about Sterling, I mean, he's a guy who voted for Trump not once but twice. But he's also a guy who has really been very clear in his messaging about debunking. And he's gone through, in these press conferences he's held in the last month or two, he's just gone through almost every conceivable insane notion that's been put forward about the election in Georgia and just clearly and efficiently debunked each and every one in these press conferences and also on Twitter. Yesterday on Twitter, as he's done at press conferences, quite notably and I guess bravely, he's laid at the feet of Trump the blame for both the death threats that were coming into his office and Secretary Raffensperger's office weeks and weeks ago, and also what happened at the Capitol yesterday. And that's pretty rare among Republicans, frankly, anywhere in this country, but especially in Georgia. To the rest of your question, you know, the San Diego woman who was killed as she tried to enter the Capitol yesterday had last posted, apparently, on Twitter, about Georgia lawyer Lynn Wood, a truly deranged Trump attorney here in Georgia who I've spoken to a few times, who I think can be thought of as sort of the opposite of a Gabe Sterling Republican. He's He's a guy who's been fanning the flames of misinformation, who's been taking up the Stop the Steal banner. And so, you know, I think we can, there's a pretty clear line we can draw between at least one protester yesterday who was killed and the rhetoric coming from a noteworthy Georgia GOP person in Lynn Wood. I've also spoken to Atlanta's Tea Party leader, who I personally find to be actually a quite amiable woman, Debbie Dooley. I was shocked yesterday to see her post on Twitter, "Burn, baby, burn." I mean, I know that she supports Stop the Steal, but it still stunned me that a person who's, I think, you know, caring and compassionate in her own way, saw the drama at the Capitol through a completely different lens. And also, it's worth pointing out, a former leader of the KKK showed up at Georgia's Capitol yesterday looking for Secretary Raffensperger. I guess the point is that while Georgia Democrats did something really historic yesterday, it was, which, you know, was below the fold on the front page of the Atlanta paper today, the state has still has a huge number of Trump supporters who really aren't going anywhere anytime soon. And as is the case nationally, it's going to be very hard to forge compromise and to de-escalate here in the coming days.
So I am interested, too, in a text that you got from another contact of yours, John Cowan, who lost his race for Congress to Marjorie Greene. And he texted you on Wednesday morning about Warnock's triumph, calling it a rejection of Republican populism. And he said that the Georgia GOP needs to return to compassionate Christian conservatism to inspire people. And it just struck me that this is the conundrum of the party in Georgia and across the country. So it just, given what you've been saying, it seems increasingly implausible.
Yeah, it really does. There just aren't a whole lot of John Cowans that I've run across in my reporting. He's the minority. I mean, and to give a little bit more about him and maybe why it's so wild that a figure like Marjorie Greene beat him, he's an Ivy League educated doctor who, you know, was saying the right things about the pandemic, who's intelligent, who's well-spoken. He still upholds a lot of the core Republican values of gun ownership and, you know, the border wall being important, et cetera. But he speaks rationally, and yet he couldn't get through in his primary against Green to the vast majority of voters in Northwest Georgia who supported her, someone who basically at every turn has been saying nonsense about the pandemic, about the elections. So I see Marjorie Greene, unfortunately for Republicans and I guess all Americans, as more the face of the future of the Republican Party here in Georgia, rather than John Cowan.
Thanks so much, Charles.
You're welcome.
Charles Bethea is a staff writer at The New Yorker based in Atlanta. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron, Michelle Moses, and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.